Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week, Emmy Award-winning composer Van Eyn will talk about the world premiere of The Odyssey at the Yerba Buena Center. It's a musical epic inspired by the experiences of the Vietnamese boat people. Bill English from San Francisco Playhouse will be on hand to discuss his production of Jennifer Haley's The Nether, which explores the moral and psychological implications of human relationships in an increasingly technological age. Plus, Hershey Felder is back in the Bay Area, this time in a one-man show portraying Irving Berlin at TheaterWorks Silicon Valley. You'll also hear about the rather campy reverse drag version of Star Trek Live at the Oasis. Stay with us. My first guest, Hershey Felder, has made a career of performing one-man shows in which he personifies some of the greatest musicians of all time from all eras, from Beethoven, Franz Liszt, and Frédéric Chopin, to George Gershwin and Leonard Bernstein, the latter three of which enjoyed extended runs at Berkeley Rep. In addition to being an award-winning actor, Hershey is a composer in his own right and recording artist. He's back in the Bay Area to tell the story of America's composer, Irving Berlin, someone he's called America's Mozart, for a show that recently broke all records down at the Geffen Playhouse. Audiences in Mountain View have a chance to see the show at TheaterWorks Silicon Valley through February 14th. Hershey, welcome back to Open Air.
Thank you for having me. Question.
Yes.
What is reverse drag?
I think it's where instead of men portraying women, women portray men.
That's reverse. Okay.
I might be my own invention.
I think it's your, I don't know. It was cool. I'd never heard about reverse drag.
It might be a malapropism. We'll find out.
Well,
I think the last time we talked was about your Bernstein show at
Yes, and we talked about how Bernstein was not nice to you.
He was tremendously nice.
Oh, yeah. You keep on telling that story.
He just wanted me to do other things than play the flute, that's all.
Yeah, which indicates how nice he was, is that to us.
Well, he was in his bathrobe, I should say. No. Anyway.
Too much information,
TMI,
man.
You want the whole story? Go to my website. No. Anyway, it was a wonderful show and really did
nail
Leonard Bernstein, so to speak.
Already off to that direction. It's a family-friendly show, isn't it?
Well,
that's what your producer said.
segueing on, he's joined by his director, Trevor Hay, who has worked with Hershey on several of his productions. Trevor began working with the historic Old Globe Theater in San Diego at the knobby-kneed age of 9 and stayed for over 32 years. He's also worked on the Broadway productions of Damn Yankees, Dr. Seuss, How the Grinch Stole Christmas, and Twyla Tharp's The Times They Are A-Changin'. Trevor, welcome to Open Air as well.
Thank you, David. Good afternoon.
Well, the sheer length of Irving Berlin's 100-year life and the breadth of his musical output must present a daunting challenge to both of you to distill down into an evening's entertainment. More than 1,500 songs, dozens of which made the top of the pop charts, from his first hit, Alexander's Ragtime Band, to White Christmas and Easter Parade, tunes from Annie Get Your Gun, Blue Skies, Putting on the Ritz. We only have an hour. I can't even go through a quarter of the song list. God Bless America. Hoy, such music. I'm failing here. Please tell me you've kept What'll I Do in the mix.
What'll I Do is right there at the top, 1922.
Is it really?
Written when his mother died, which is a little bit creepy, isn't it? Mm. You know, what'll I do with, you know, just a photograph to tell my troubles to?
It's
because he was constantly feeling a great sense of loneliness, especially because he lost so many people throughout his young life first. Mm. He lost his entire village. It was burned down when he was 5 years old, and that's his earliest memory of coming to America because a pogrom took out his village. After that, he lost his father when he was 13 of a bronchial infection. you know, in the Lower East Side in Manhattan, you didn't survive those things. When he was a young man, he lost his wife, Dorothy, after 5 months of marriage. She died of typhoid fever from their honeymoon. And then his mother dies. And so all of a sudden, there was a deep sense of loneliness, and you feel that Berlin is writing these songs to fill some kind of void. And in so doing, what he does is he communicates directly to what people feel in a most basic way. And he always said he wrote for the people. And, you know, it's interesting. If you look at poetry and you look at lyrics, there are a lot of lyrics that are clever. His are so clever that you don't see how clever they are. Mm. They're so even and clear and honest. Just like that lyric of the song you said, you know, what'll I do with just a photograph to tell my troubles to?
Well, I was going to wait a little bit to do this little excerpt, but since we're on What'll I Do, let's hear Julie London's interpretation.
Anything
of that.
To get me to stop talking.
What'll I do when you are far away and I am What'll I do? What'll I do when I am wondering who is kissing you? What'll I do? What'll I do with just a photograph to tell my troubles to? When I'm alone with only dreams of you, that won't come true. What'll I do?
Music by a man who knew from personal experience the art of the ballad. And beautiful singing there, Hershey. I didn't realize you had such range. Not going to buy it, are you?
Not even
a crack smile.
Oh, no, I smiled. Jesus.
That's Julie London recording of What'll I Do.
We have a reverse drag Irving Berlin that we're doing at the Midnight Show. So if you want to come down to Mountain View.
Special drinks involved, I'm sure. Well, as I mentioned before, so much source material involved. Are you imitating Irving Berlin in mannerism as well, or just
you were at the Bernstein show, right? So what I tend to do is not imitation. I'm afraid of imitation because I think imitation lands up being imitation. I think the word, if we want to attach any word to something, it would be evocation. You look for the mannerism. You create an illusion based on a selection of items that tell a particular story, whether it's the story itself, whether it's things that you do with the voice, where the colors, whatever it is, and they create an illusion of what that evocation is. There are certain actors who imitate, and it's a fine craft to imitate, but I think in something like this, if you're going to spend an hour and a half or 2 hours trying to convince an audience that you are that person and telling that story, what you don't want to do is an imitation, because eventually that, for me, I'm not saying it's for everybody, but for me that lands up being emotionless. And if you want it to be real, then it has to be real on the terms that you are setting and the audience is setting, is that you're there, you're present, and to be as honest with them as possible.
Well, talk to me a little bit more about your creative process there and the inevitable editing process, where I'm sure Trevor comes in, that must have left more than a few wonderful tunes on the theatrical cutting room floor.
Well, actually, interesting. I think we've only, since the beginning of this show, we've only thrown out one song that's Cohen owes me $97. It just didn't work.
Didn't fit. Very funny. Didn't fit.
Yeah. Very funny. And half of a song that he wrote when his son passed away. Because he lost a child in a crib death, and his only son.
But in the original construction of the show, you went through a lot of music.
Oh, but before we actually set the script, the selection process was complicated.
It's massive. You know, like you said, 1,500 songs. Good where point, do you yeah. start? Yeah.
But it always had to be a song that would advance the story. As long as we advance the story, and in the case of Irving Berlin, strangely, it's almost as if he wrote the show for us, because his life was put into his songs, and America was put into the songs. And so what landed up happening, it was about choosing the song that clearly identified how to advance the story, and he left it for us. He left the map, so it made our jobs a lot easier.
That's Hershey Felder. He is Irving Berlin at the Mountain View Center for the Performing Arts, Theater Works, Silicon Valley. He's here with his director, Trevor Hay. You mentioned his son passing. I understand that Berlin's daughters actually have caught the show. Did they give you any sort of further insight into your characterization?
Oh, more than just caught the show. We became very friendly. I didn't want to do the show originally because I, you know, had this snob sense about me. Oh, I only do Beethoven, I only do Bernstein, I only do those people, you know, Gershwin for good measure. But it was they and a friend of ours that actually convinced us this would be a good thing. And once I got into it, I realized what a genius the man is, arguably America's Mozart. All right, he didn't write the notes down, but arguably America's Mozart in the genius of how he was able to pick things out of the air. The daughters then introduced us to the whole family material. They introduced us to things that people had never seen or actually knew. But what the daughters gave us, and this was very specific, was what he was really like. And they said very clearly that it's not a rose-colored view. He was as patriotic as his sons indicate. It was not the way some jaded people would say, oh, he was just, you know, a huckster who was finding a way, social climbing and American climbing and that kind of thing, an immigrant who was trying to be American. Very much so, he was grateful. And they said it was absolutely real, and God Bless America really did mean something to him. That's why I wrote it. And so them giving us that was really, and they're very dear, and they've adopted me as their father. Oh, it's lovely. Very sweet.
Very nice. Well, let's touch on something you mentioned earlier about the pogrom. Earlier in our broadcast day, we heard on Fresh Air with Terry Gross about the re-release of Hitler's Mein Kampf and the rise of anti-Semitism in Germany in the late 20s, or even early 20s. I think people lose sight of the fact, the very chilling facts, that Tsarist Russia and their prejudice against the Jewish people.
Well, Tsarist Russia, you know, was a terrible place. It operated differently than Nazi Germany did, but I think ultimately one is an extension of an ideology that just keeps on going and does what it does. I'm very interested in seeing The Son of Saul, which just got nominated today. It's a fascinating idea to watch it put so clearly on screen that way. There's a Holocaust story. But yeah, Tsarist Russia was very scary. And, of course, people had to get out. But that's what led Irving Berlin to really be so in love with his country, because it gave him a freedom that Tsarist Russia, of course, didn't. He knew his house wouldn't be burned down. But what he also saw was enough years of committing to the country. And at the end of it, after 60 years, the country kind of discarded him. They moved on from him. And that really infuses the drama of this show.
Interesting. You mentioned how God Bless America really informs his life, and it's informed by his life. Mm-hmm. Tell us about what happens with the royalties of that song.
Trevor, you know this story.
Well, this speaks to the man and what a mensch he was and what a patriot. He'd written a song that we all know, that's been played forever, that has been on every major occasion, both joyful and sorrowful. And he gave every penny in perpetuity to the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts of America. And it continues up until this day. It's been this incredible boon, and he gave it from the heart, not as a business decision, he didn't have people spinning his image for him. It was just the right thing to do, and he wanted to give back. He was always giving back, whether it was writing for the Army or whether it was touring with the company on the front lines during the war, or donating songs or playing charity events. He was always there.
Mm-hmm. Now, Hershey, you mentioned that he didn't write the notes. Did you have access to, or have you played his famous trick piano? And could you explain what that trick piano was all about for those that don't know?
He called it a trick piano because it does, because it's several of them are still around, it does what the current, you know, transposing electronic instruments do today. He had a little lever, and at the bottom of the instrument, the lever would shift the hammers, and the hammers would move up and down the strings. And that meant he could always play in one key and yet still have it sound in multiple keys. He could only play in F sharp, so he claimed. However, there is video where you see him playing with Dinosaur. And he's pounding, and I see a couple of white notes. I mean, I also know that there are white notes in there. So he wasn't glued to the black ones.
Uh-huh.
And
well, he couldn't be. I mean,
yeah, of course not.
But as exotic, right?
but he did compose an F sharp, as he says in the show. The black notes, they stick out much easier to find.
I'm sure it was part of his shtick as
I
time
think,
evolved.
You know, I think, you know,
tried and true.
Two sides of that. One, that it was part of his shtick, and also, you know, he hated that he was constantly referred to, even though he was the most famous songwriter in the world, as a singing waiter. Who made good. But I think there was a part of him that says, I'm the singing Guaita who made good, you know? So there's that.
And he continues to make good in terms of his royalties from God Bless America. Now, you've gone back as far as Beethoven and as forward as Bornstein, as we talked about. Which direction...
I like Bornstein. That's good.
Which direction...
You gotta use that.
Where might you be heading for another...
in the middle.
Personification.
Well, I think we're heading toward the last one, because I think it's time for other kinds of stories, and this last one is Tchaikovsky. It opens this year.
Fantastic.
That's a really great story, because nobody knows what happened to him or how he died or why. It's all a big mystery, and uncovering that mystery to the extent that we can is a lot of fun, especially, which I find fascinating, you know, that Tchaikovsky likely was either killed or committed suicide or simply died, something to do with the fact that he was a homosexual. And now, of course, you know, in his day, if that would have been revealed, he would have been relegated to Siberia, and that is if he was lucky. And now, of course, Putin, the great leader, is, you know,
there's so many of those around.
Yeah,
great leaders.
Is introducing the Sochi Olympics, you know, and of course homosexuals are not welcome, with big Tchaikovsky blaring in the background.
Exactly.
It's such a wonderful...
Isn't that beautiful?
It's a
moment?
Wonderful place to start a play.
Yeah.
And, you know, and as with these stories, they never get out of date, because there's always things to deal with when it comes to them. So,
Man. Well, I understand, Trevor, you were involved with a piece with Hershey involving Abraham Lincoln's piano.
We certainly were. Abraham was President Lincoln was a player, but it was really more about that whole piece centered around the doctor, Dr. Leal. It's a true story that not a lot of people know. Charles Augustus Leal was an army surgeon who was at Ford's Theater that night, and when the famous cry, now infamous cry, "Is there a doctor in the house?" uttered by Mary Todd, Charles Leal sprung from the balcony, busted down the door that John Wilkes Booth had barred, and was with Lincoln for the last hours of his life. And
wow.
So we tell the story from that point of view. And
now, hold on. Wait a minute. I understand the piano of Abraham Lincoln, but wait a minute.
How does this all fit?
You're a Canadian citizen. You're going to portray an American president. Has the Ted Cruz campaign contacted you for any tips yet?
Well, yeah.
The rules are getting looser and looser. Well, it's fine.
But here's the point. I mean, being a Canadian, but I'm a short, fat Jewish boy who's presenting at 6'4".
Other challenges involved.
It's all lighting.
I'm not sure the Canadian problem is the biggest one. But the fact remains is that one of the things that is interesting, if you look at these characters, the ones that have become the most popular here in America and the ones that are most beloved are the Gershwin, the Bernstein, and the Berlin, told from the perspective of themselves through the eyes of somebody who grew up in Montreal, Canada, a very European place to begin with. But I am an immigrant. So, and all these, I mean, George Gershwin was born in New York, but he was essentially an immigrant in terms of where he came from. He was a Russian family. Berlin, born somewhere else. Bernstein, also. His parents spoke with a heavy accent. So this is something you people say, what do you have in common? Oh, it's the musicianship. Well, no, I'm a decent musician. But what I really have in common is that I have the understanding of coming from the outside and really wanting to be part of something very, very special, which this country is and the arts in this country are. And that is a certain perspective that seems to infuse all these things. And it's interesting how people say it's that it's fascinating how it takes somebody from a faraway land, it's just up north, from a faraway land, to be able to see things more clearly when they come to another home.
That's Hershey Felder. He is Irving Berlin down in Silicon Valley at Mountain View Center for the Performing Arts. Thanks for coming in again, Hershey.
Thank you.
And Trevor Hay is a producer for sharing some anecdotes about Berlin as well. Someone who could always see the blue skies, Irving Berlin. Here's the great Art Tatum. You can hear the great Hershey Felder as Irving Berlin in Mountain View through the 14th of February. Information at theaterworks.org. Thanks again, guys. Art Tatum performing Irving Berlin's Blue Skies. You can hear Hershey Felder's interpretation of that tune through the 14th. Hershey Felder as Irving Berlin, Theater Works, Silicon Valley on Castro Street in Mountain View. Theater Works, it's a theater with an R-E, theaterworks.org for more information. Still to come, Van Eyn will talk about the world premiere of The Odyssey at the Yerba Buena Center. And you'll also hear about an interesting drag version of Star Trek Live and Mudd's Women at the Oasis. Stay with us here on Open Air. Well, the San Francisco Playhouse will kick off 2016 with Jennifer Haley's mind-blowing play, The Nether, which challenges audiences to confront an explosive and controversial conversation that resonates with disturbing current events of the day. The Nether asks the question, how can the virtual world be policed, and should it be? Delighted to welcome back Bill English, the artistic director and director of the play. He's also a co-founder with his wife, Susie Donnellino, of S. San Francisco Playhouse. And he is focused as well on work at SF Playhouse as a set builder and probably a dishwasher, no doubt. His work has, with the Playhouse, has seen in just 13 years or so, has seen its growth from just a storefront to an award-winning major regional theater company. Bill, it's such a pleasure to welcome you back here.
Oh, it's great to be back. Thanks, Dave.
Well, The Nether is set in the future, but it's informed by things that are happening now.
Well, it's definitely a not too distant future. It's a future in which more and more people are spending more and more of their time in virtual realities. That is, they're hooked up to the helmet or to life support even, and they go on these trips into world's domains that are created for them. They even speak of crossing over. Some people in this world have been spending all of their time. They go on life support and spend 24/7 in virtual realities. And I think it's fair to say now that the internet is a giant, wasteland frontier where anything goes and anybody can do anything. And this is certainly true of the Nether, which is simply another word for the internet. Really?
Well, Jennifer Haley's specializes in this kind of, what would you call it, a dystopia, sci-fi noir. How do you want to characterize this?
Yeah, it's definitely got its sci-fi elements. It also feels like it's very much a thriller and also a very unusual love story. So it's got a lot of elements. I think, you know, the contemporary issues that are brought up, of course, are, you know, artistic expression versus First Amendment rights. You know, do I have the right to do whatever I want as long as I'm not hurting someone? You know, again, I can create a world where any kind of sexual deviance is possible, but it's not real.
Hmm.
So the play tries to define what does real mean. Does real have consequences to the people who are behind the digital characters they play, the avatars they play in the internet? And, of course, there's a raging debate going on about that right now in our culture and all over the world.
So without giving away the whole shebang, give us a synopsis of what happens in Jennifer Haley's play.
Well, a very, very a brilliant cyber criminal, we'll call him, because he's created a domain called The Hideaway, which is sort of a 19th century mansion where avatars can go and engage in sort of illicit sexual behavior.
But as they're in their virtual world.
In the virtual world. Okay. It's all virtual. And he's been brought in by a detective, a young female detective, who is a little spurious who she works for. It's almost like a slightly vigilante organization, or the internet itself has decided to police itself before the government steps in. So she's brought this guy in for questioning by force to try and find out how he's doing it, where his servers are, so she can cut him off. His argument is, I'm not doing anything wrong. And so the debate between them alternates with cutaways to scenes that are actually happening in his hideaway.
I don't know why I have in my head this view of two worlds combining, like Who Framed Roger Rabbit? But I know I shouldn't be going there at all.
Yeah, well, they don't actually meet, but in a way that's not too far from the truth, in the sense that, you know, what people do in the virtual world impacts what they do in this other world.
So how are you portraying this for the audience visually?
Well, I don't want to give it away, actually, because we are doing some hocus-pocus magic to transport the audience more or less instantly from this very concrete and steel in a bunker somewhere interrogation room into the beautiful foyer of a Victorian mansion, into the beautiful bedroom with gorgeous wallpaper.
Suffice to say that projections are involved.
Actually not. Believe it or not, you're in a show that Bill English is producing at San Francisco Playhouse that does not have projections. The set's by Nina Ball, who works a lot with us, of course, and is one of the Bay Area's finest set designers. And, of course, I actually don't build the sets at all anymore. I design a lot of them, but the sets are all built by Zach Sigmund, who is our amazing technical theater manager. And this is a pretty amazing set.
Okay, so we'll wait with bated breath on that. Tell us about your cast, then. You can tell us about your cast, of course.
Well, we've got a fabulous cast. David Warren Keith, who's sort of a Bay Area legend, works at all the great theaters, ACT, Berkeley Rep, has worked at Cal Shake's Marin Theater Company, is playing the sort of arch criminal. A young woman named Rebo Chen, who is from New York, from the NYU Acting School, is playing the detective. Louis Parnell is playing another character. Josh Schell, yet another character.
So when did you first see Jennifer Haley's The Nether?
Well, I saw it in New York, I think about a year ago. And I also saw it in London. So I've seen two productions of it, one at the Royal Court in London at MCC in New York. But before that, I had heard about the production in Los Angeles, which was the first at the Kirk Douglas Theater. And I ordered up a script immediately after reading the reviews, thinking, wow, what a thought-provoking and powerful drama, and read it and just fell completely in love with it and have been campaigning for the rights to perform it ever since.
Well, its New York engagement at MCC was extended three times. It was winner of the 2012 Susan Smith Blackburn Prize. So it's gotten some great acclaim well before it came across the radar there. What I'm also wondering, Bill, is when you see a production like this and want to bring it to the San Francisco Playhouse stage, do you immediately think, this is what I'd like to do differently, or X would be the perfect person to direct, in this case, X being I.
Well, I often do. It's like I see a production, I think, I've read it to begin with, so I have created a visualization in my mind of what it's going to look like, and then you see it, and of course, my imagination is never going to match up to someone else's, and so I think I'd rather do this that way, or I'd like to do my show this way. That's pretty typical of most artists, I think. I think in the casting of it, I noticed a couple of common casting choices that were made by the New York and the London productions, and I sort of thought, oh, I don't know. I kind of might rather go a slightly different direction with this character. And so in a couple of cases, we have cast an actor who's very different from the actors that played the productions that I saw.
Mm-hmm. It's Bill English, director of The Nether by Jennifer Haley. Did Jennifer have any input into this production, or have you invited her to come to have a look?
I've talked to her 3 or 4 times on the phone, lengthy conversations, because part of working on the show means kind of understanding the world. It's a fictional world that takes place in the future, and it's got rules. All worlds have rules. And so talking to her a lot about the nature of the world. And then there are characters who appear in the real world. We call it the real world, tentatively. But they also, those characters appear as avatars in the virtual world. And they're played by different actors in some cases. So how do you help the audience understand that the behinder, we call them the behinder, is the person we've met in the interrogation room? So some of the choices that they made in New York and London, I've kind of thought, I might like to try something a little different with the type of actor. In other words, you cast a very, very tough, sort of statue kind of person who's not very communicative, or you cast, on the other hand, somebody who's quite responsive and warm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You have a wild gamut of range, that you have hopefully to choose from.
Mm. Well, it sounds like a really interesting production.
But she and I have also talked about the characters and in depth, in terms of the young detective. The young detective, I didn't realize this, but Jen was letting me know she's sort of like a young idealist, like she could be a revolutionary or she could be a religious zealot. She wants to change things, and so she's coming from the idealism of youth. Mm. And that was a real eye opener. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In terms of, she's almost sort of a Tea Party type person in the sense that she's got these strong, very conservative convictions.
Interesting. All right.
Which I thought was really fascinating.
Yeah, I should say. Gosh. Yeah. Well, it sounds like a fascinating world we can discover at the San Francisco Playhouse. I thank you for coming in today. Please give my love to Susie and to Lauren.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Jennifer Haley's The Nether runs through March 5th at the San Francisco Playhouse. Information at sfplayhouse.org. Still to come, an interesting version of Star Trek Live at the Oasis and music of another refugee situation that's going to be playing at the Yerba Buena Center. Here's some music from that and more to come.
More. the sun don't let the
That's music written by and performed by Van Eyn, Oscar-nominated and Emmy Award-winning composer. She premieres a new musical epic inspired by the experiences of the Vietnamese boat people. Marking the 40th anniversary of the end of the Vietnam War, The Odyssey explores the personal and spiritual journeys of the boat people escaping war and abandoning their lives in the search for freedom with an alien and unknowable future. Timely indeed, and utilizes new music for Vietnamese and Western instruments, ambient sound, spoken word, historical objects, and live media. It's at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts through next Saturday, and was conceived by composer Van Eyn, who is a performer of Vietnamese traditional instruments and an emerging composer. She was a Vietnam national champion on traditional instruments, who has also been a collaborator with the likes of the Kronos Quartet, Houston Grand Opera, and other artists in jazz, rap, and world music realms. I'm so pleased to welcome Van Eyn to our studios. Hi.
Hi, hello. Tremendous.
It's hard to believe that it was 40 years ago that the real-life odyssey of the Vietnam exodus took place. Now, what is your family connection to the whole Vietnamese boat people?
I am from north of Vietnam, and I came here in recent 2001 after married to my husband. My main connections to other community actually were from friends that I make here, because all of my friends here are from south of Vietnam, and so do my husband family. They are from south of Vietnam. But since I moved here, I start to learn the story from other side of the war. And when I listen to their story, I just feel like war is so, you know, destructive. Because in my own side, in northern side, we had to go through a lot of struggle and, you know, consequences of war. But then I didn't really have a chance to know about it until I move here and I hear the other part, the other half that it has been missing in the whole context.
Can you remind our audience of what kind of numbers were involved with the number of people that were considered the Vietnamese boat people? How many people were actually involved in the exodus?
It's reached up to more than 2 million people.
Oh, my stars. I had no idea that.
Yes, and 100,000 of people actually die on the sea because of starvation, storm, pirates, and many, many more of that. And my heart should get more sad. And, you know, since I working on this production, all the music came out, become very dark and sad. But then starting from middle of last year, when I see the news about the refugees from Syria, I just told myself that why someone up there, you know, who has power, just look at the history of Vietnamese boat people, and they can find the answer right there.
Yeah, yeah, it's a history repeating itself. We were just talking with Hershey Felder about Irving Berlin, who experienced the same prejudice mm-hmm. against the Jews in both Russia and Germany, and it's we don't learn. The humanity is just not learning from its own mistakes. It's horrible. So tell me a bit how you're mixing the Vietnamese music with other forms. Is it a problem when it comes to scale, a Western scale versus a Vietnamese-based?
I come from a music genre that relatively is very small and new to any other music genre in the world, especially music genre that you have or we have here in America. So in that terms, I don't think much about scale. I don't think in a technical way, because that will give me too many reasons of not doing it, because it's just too different, too difficult for me to think about that way. So I just think, like, how about thinking of using the color of my instrument and work with the using music as a way of express emotion? And that's the universal voice that, you know, sadness is sadness. Everyone will have their different type of sadness, but when you hear a sad piece of music, you know it. When you hear a hopeful piece of music, you know it. Or something that nurtures from music, you know it. So I come from that point of view to work with Western music. And so I feel much more freedom, yeah.
Well, you're working with some incredible musicians, including my good friend cellist Alex Kelly.
Yes, yes. It has been very exciting to work with Alex Kelly's, and other member of the group is Dan Cantrell on accordion, and Jimmy Nakagawa on taiko drums and percussion. And the combination that you can hear, that now Vietnamese traditional instruments and with the cello and with the accordion, mm-hmm. and then with taiko drum, which is a very powerful type of the drum. But it works all well, because, again, we come together and we think that the main thing is that we have to be able to listen to each other and find a way to talk to each other in music.
Right. Are you composing this music? Mm-hmm. Are you using Vietnamese folk song as some of your source material?
Oh,
is there
yes.
improvisation involved? So tell me how you're structuring the music.
Because this is a theatrical piece and multimedia, which means that we have to use a lot of different means of music, of art. So it has to be well written and run exactly the way that it was planned for. So rarely that we will have the part that we improvise. Everything have to well written down to keep it run as it is. But the main material of music that I have been using actually came from the research and from the interviews with boat peoples that I have done. For example, when I do the research, I have been interviewed more than 50 boat peoples, and many more that I just speak to, you know, on the side. Many of them are my friends, but I did not interview them because I just want to interview people who I don't know so that they can give me the truth, you know, like not holding anything back. Many boat people that I talk to, and during the interview, I find out sounds that they remember, textures that they have in their mind, and even what helped them to hang on to the next minute, not even next hour. They didn't even think about next hour. They told me that they just think about what would happen, would they be alive in the next minute, and what did they do. Many of them actually hum the lullabies that they heard since they were a child. And that's a brilliant and so special for me, because Vietnam has 54 ethnics, and each of ethnic groups will have their own lullabies, and all of our lullabies were about love and nurturing each other. So, you know, it's just too, I should feel it's, that it's amazing how lullabies could help them to hold on hope and hold on the strength that they have to find to surpass the struggle, because when you don't know what will happen to you, you go back to the things that you know best, which is the lullaby, that scene you heard from. Mm.
Perhaps you treat us to a lullaby of your own composing, yes, or based on another?
Yes. So this is...
First of all, tell me about the instrument that you brought with you today.
I have the Vietnamese đàn bộ, the one-string instrument. And this instrument actually was invented in 9th century. But then the electronic version that we have in the studio today, that I will have the speaker, horn speaker, is like programmed that.
Almost like a bullhorn.
Yes, yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. And this is a very new version. We just have it about 60 years back to now.
And it's about, I'd say, what, 48 inches long or so?
Yes, mm-hmm. And it has a little stick up on my left side.
Right, as like and a we bridge, call it,
yeah,
so to speak.
It's just like the guitar whammy bar, if you can tell.
Sure.
Yeah, but it's made by buffalo, water buffalo horn, and it allow me to bend up and down, get pitch, like slide from one pitch to 5 step up and 2.5 step down seamlessly.
So it's like pressing on the string to change its length, basically, right? To make the wah.
Yes, in that term, but I just pull up and down. And maybe if you ever listen or see the theremin, Western theremin, maybe you can get closer, you know.
Okay, and the instrument is called?
Đàn bộ.
Đàn bộ.
Yes.
Van Ein and the đàn bộ live here in Studio A in KLW's temporary quarters. That's Van Eyn and then playing the Don Bo live in studio here at KLW. Wow, that is stunningly haunting music. It's really amazing.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That's my own lullaby, and I do use the violin bow to bow the instruments. That's a new technique that I've been using, and I also turn and do it on the back of the bow, and then plucking the instrument in the traditional way.
She'll be joined by Jimmy Nakagawa on taiko and percussion, Dan Cantrell on accordion and piano, as well as cellist Alex Kelly. Philip Blackburn is the sound artist and ethnomusicologist involved, and media artist Ian Winters creates multiple layers of stories in this production of The Odyssey. It's from Vietnam to America, reflecting the resilience of the human spirit and the price of freedom. It's at the Yerba Buena Center Forum on Mission Street. More information at ybca.org. And more information about what Van Eyn is up to is at her website, vananhvo.com. Van Eyn, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you, my pleasure.
All the best with this production. It's really...
Thank you.
Sounds like it's some stunning music ahead. ybca.org for more information about The Odyssey. Well, a journey of a different kind awaits you at the Oasis in San Francisco. That's the unmistakable music from the classic Star Trek production that launched the whole franchise back in 1966 or so. Well, after a completely sold-out run in October of 2015, Star Trek Live has returned through January 23rd at the Oasis. Critics and audiences are raving, and the drag kings and Trekkies all are living in harmony. Here to talk about this production is its director, Darcy Dollinger. He is, among others, a director of such classics as The Temple of Poon, SN Champagne, Project Lohan, Above and Beyond the Valley of the Ultra Showgirls, Suburbia 3000. The list goes on. He's also co-owner and artistic director of Oasis. Darcy, welcome back.
Thank you so much.
I think we were talking about that champagne show last time we were together.
Yes, that was a fun run, and we're actually doing the third and final installment this year of the Champagne Trilogy.
Oh, very nice, very nice. Well, this Star Trek stuff is ripe for parody, yet the Star Trek franchise is one of the most enduring and beloved. Now, you've chosen a memorable episode of Mudd's Women. Tell us first the history of this particular episode and how it ended up being your choice for
the
show.
You know, and I co-directed this with Laurie Bushman, and it is something that many years ago she and Lee Crow, who plays Captain Kirk, did in a warehouse south of Market. So they had, you know, tested it out 12 years ago in front of an audience and knew that it worked. It also had the three women that were great for the drag queens. But when we took it to do it at Oasis, we thought it would be similar to our other TV show and movie parodies, but we quickly realized that the avid fan base, the Trekkies, were not our normal audience. So we had to pay attention to everything. And Sarah Pikett, our production manager at Oasis, found online the blueprints for the entire bridge.
Fantastic.
We couldn't afford the bridge, but we could afford and had space to make Captain Kirk's chair.
Iconic.
For
iconic.
So we actually have a full replica of Captain Kirk's throne. We also found almost all the incidental music from the original episode. So all the music you hear during the show is almost all the original show music. And we worked really hard to get the costumes and wigs the same. So it's it's campy, but it's also almost like a restoration piece.
Right. Speaking of some of that incidental music, you use it very effectively in the show. Since Lee Crow couldn't be with us, let's have her introduce Mudd's Women.
Captain's log, start date 1329.1. We've taken aboard from an unregistered transport vessel its captain and three unusual females. These women have a mysterious magnetic effect on the male members of my crew, including myself. Explanation unknown at present.
She's amazing.
That's Lee Crow as Captain Kirk. You know, the timing is pretty amazing because, you know, Shatner's world is at the Warfield on the 30th.
I was wishing so much we could collide a little bit. But, yeah, I mean, Lee's amazing. She really just nails Captain Kirk. And, you know, she used to be a female Elvis impersonator. So she can really handle some of these male roles so well. She's hilarious. We also have Honey Mahogany from RuPaul's Drag Race and some other amazing drag kings that are really really funny, as well as the three queens that play Mudd's Women.
So tell me, are all the women's roles played by men and men by women? Or?
Correct. We've crossed the gender completely. So we have a female Mudd and male women, you know, men playing the women. So it's a completely gender-crossed drag show. And audiences love the drag kings nowadays. They're really kind of coming into their own, and people want to see them more and more. We're also doing a big drag king show later in the month, so we're seeing more and more that there's a huge audience for that.
Fantastic. And I imagine the costumes are pretty much those iconic uniforms that were used in the show.
And Mudd's Women were the exact – we replicated the entire wardrobe. So Amy Sarrazin did the costumes, and she did a great job at that. So like I said, we really tried to, in ways we could, be true and also embellish it. I mean, you can't help but parody it because it took itself so seriously.
Indeed. At the Oasis, Star Trek Live, Mudd's Women, through the 23rd of this month. Information at Oasis, sfoasis.org. Actually, sfoasis.com. Well, Darcy, I wish we had more time to talk about this, but I know people will have a thrill coming to it anytime they can squeeze an evening out. They'll be sure to be well rewarded.
Absolutely.
Star Trek Live at the SF Oasis, sfoasis.com for more information. Thanks for coming in briefly. That's Open Air for this week. I do encourage you to attend Sarah Cahill's concert. She's doing a concert through Noe Valley Chamber Music this Sunday, the 17th, at 4 o'clock, including music by Handel, Stefan Wolp, Sofia Gubaidulina, Danny Clay, Henry Purcell, and Carl Nielsen. Information at nvcm.org. My thanks to producer Neil Swinkles for making the wheels click here on Open Air, including helping hold an Ein's instrument during her performance in studio in our temporary spaces here. Also, a reminder that our shows are archived at our website, kalw.org. If you've got a show suggestion, by all means, drop me an email, david@kalw.org. I'm taking a week off. Kevin Vance will be in the chair next week hosting Open Air. I do hope you'll come and have a listen. And do listen to these shows archived at our website, klw.org.